Ending on what I think is perhaps, for my estimation, the most exciting note. We're ending with a debate, a naturalist-theist debate. And I'm particularly interested in this debate because it features two young scholars, two people on opposing sides of the issues of faith and non-belief, who, interestingly enough, are friends. They have known each other for over 10 years, and they actually last debated 9 years ago. Debates are very important to us. The idea of debate is obviously very important to the concept of free inquiry. When you think of free inquiry, you think of analyzing the issues. And what better way to get at issues than to have two highly skilled, highly intelligent, learned individuals making their presentations on their side of the issues. So with that brief introduction, I'd like to mention that this debate is sponsored in conjunction with our Campus Freethought Alliance, which is a international network of campus groups and individuals promoting free thought throughout high schools and colleges in America. And I'd like to introduce the director of that program, Ms. Amanda Chesworth.
Thank you. Thank you. Welcome. This is quite an exciting time for the Campus Freethought Alliance. This is the launch of our debate circuit. It's going to start off as a national debate circuit, going across the country at various our campus groups, at conferences, in the community, and we're hoping to have a regular series of debates on a variety of religious topics and non-religious topics, anything of interest to free thinkers. We're hoping to work with people like Dr. Phil Fernandez and provide these debates for the public. And if you would like any more information about that, we have a table outside, and it has a preliminary debate kit that we're giving to our student groups, hoping that they'll take part in our debates. Debates can be very successful as far as bringing in the crowd, and they can educate people on the free thought movement and raise awareness that we exist. We have several professional debaters among our organization, and we also have a lot of students that would like to debate. And we have panel discussions and what we call a one-man show, where one person, the audience, will be the other side, and they question and challenge the debater. And we're hoping that this will become a regular event across the country in however many years that we can provide it. So welcome and enjoy. Thank you.
We're very fortunate today to have a skilled debater as our moderator. In fact, he's someone from just down the road in Raleigh. Dr. Doug Jessup is professor of philosophy at North Carolina State. And if those of you are the kind that check out the Internet Infidels website, you'll notice that many of his sterling debates have been chronicled by the infidels. And he's debated many, many people, and he says that one of his most exciting debates was the existence of God against William Lane Craig. So I will now turn everything over to him, and we will commence the debate. Dr. Jessup.
Thank you. Our topic is naturalism versus theism, where does the evidence point? It's a great pleasure to be able to hear these two skilled debaters, Jeffrey J. Lauder, president of Internet Infidels Incorporated, and Dr. Phil Fernandez of the Institute for Biblical Defense. Our format will be 20-minute opening statements, followed by 12-minute rebuttals, followed by 8-minute second rebuttals, and then 5-minute closing statements. In the interest of moving things along, I would urge you to refrain from any heckling and ranting and raving at points you don't agree with, as well as demonstrative approvals, and we can try to keep things moving fairly smoothly. After the debates and the rebuttals and the closing statements, we'll take a brief intermission, 5 minutes, 5 or 10 minutes or so, and then we'll have 45 minutes for questions and answers, which can be directed immediately to the debaters. Mr. Lauder will be leading off with a 20-minute opening statement, and I guess it's time to get down to business.
Good afternoon. I'd like to thank the Society of Humanist Philosophers for giving me this opportunity, and I would like to thank everyone who helped organize this debate, especially Anthony Battaglia. I'm also very pleased to share the stage with my friend Dr. Phil Fernandez, who I have known for at least 9 years and who I know will prove a formidable opponent today. Today you've been asked to think about two very different ways of interpreting the world, naturalism and theism. By naturalism, I mean the belief that there are no supernatural beings. If naturalism is true, there is no God, no devil, no angels, no heaven, and no hell. Naturalists include people who call themselves atheists, materialists, secular humanists, and skeptics. By theism, I mean the belief that there is an all-powerful, all-knowing, and all-good being called God who allegedly created the universe and transcends the world, yet is immanent in it. Now, the topic before us is, when you weigh the evidence for theism against the evidence for naturalism, which way, on balance, does the evidence point? In defense of a naturalistic answer to that question, I'm going to present 8 lines of evidence which are more likely given naturalism than theism. Number one, naturalism offers the best explanation for the physical dependence of minds. Michael Tooley, a highly respected philosopher at the University of Colorado at Boulder, has stated 5 lines of evidence in support of this claim. First, certain injuries to or diseases of the brain make it impossible for a person to have any mental states at all. For example, think of someone in the final stages of Alzheimer's disease. My slide shows the difference in brain tissue between a healthy brain on the left and one with Alzheimer's on the right. Second, when an individual's brain is directly stimulated and put into a certain physical state, this causes the person to have a corresponding experience. Third, other injuries to the brain destroy various mental capacities. Which capacity is destroyed is tied directly to the particular region of the brain that was damaged. Fourth, the mental capacity of animals becomes more complex as their brains become more complex. And fifth, within any given species, the development of mental capacities is correlated with the development of neurons in the brain. In light of the evidence I just presented, Paul Draper, a highly respected agnostic philosopher, concludes that, quote, consciousness and personality are highly dependent on the brain. Nothing mental happens without something physical happening, end quote. But that strongly implies that the mind cannot exist independently of physical arrangements of matter. And this is exactly what we would expect if naturalism is true. However, if theism is true, God is a disembodied mind. God's mind is not in any sense dependent on physical arrangements of matter. But if nothing mental happens without something physical happening, that is evidence against the existence of any being who is supposed to have a disembodied mind, including God. Therefore, the physical dependence of minds is unlikely if theism is true, and that's the first reason why I think naturalism is true. Number two, naturalism offers the best explanation for the relationship between complex and simple living things. According to the National Academy of Sciences, there are 5 scientific facts which support evolution. Since my time is limited, I will discuss only 3 of those facts: the fossil record, biogeography, and molecular biology. First, the fossil evidence indicates that complex living things are the gradually modified descendants of relatively simple living things. Negatively, the fossil record disconfirms creationism. It shows that living things were not simultaneously created. We only find simple living things in the lowest layers of the fossil record. As we move forward through history, we find fishes, then amphibians, then reptiles, and then birds and mammals. Positively, the fossil record contains transitional forms. For example, we now have fossils documenting the evolution of the whale. Obviously, the artist put some flesh on the bones in my slide, but the bones show intermediates, such as the animals in the top right and bottom left of my slide. They had functional hind legs and could move on land like seals, but they also propelled themselves, as whales do, by moving the tail up and down. Finally, in the bottom right, you see a fully aquatic early whale. We've even found fossils of early whales with hind legs that were structurally complete, but too small to actually function. Second, evolution explains the relationship between geographical barriers and living things. For example, although land mammals could survive in Hawaii, they are not found there natively because they evolved on continents and couldn't cross the Pacific. Or consider the continents of Australia and South America. Again, although, say, apes could survive on either continent, apes evolved after the continents of Australia and South America broke away from earlier land masses. Third, evolution explains the genetic similarities and differences between different species. For example, the genes of present-day humans and chimps are 98% identical. But it's even better than that. Human beings and chimps even share something called pseudogenes, genes that are not functional today, but apparently served a purpose in the past. The most plausible explanation of these genetic similarities and differences is that all living things share a common ancestor. Now, if evolution is true, then God is not needed to account for the various life forms that exist today and have existed in the past. And therefore, evolution is compatible with naturalism. If theism is true, however, evolution may or may not be true. Evolution is logically compatible with theism. God could have used evolution, but God could have used many other methods than evolution, methods which are ruled out by naturalism. Moreover, given that 99% of the species that have ever lived on Earth are now extinct, evolution seems like a pretty strange way for an all-powerful being to create living organisms. Did God have to keep experimenting until he got things right? Thus, evolution is some evidence for naturalism over theism. Number three, naturalism offers the best explanation for the biological role of physical pain and pleasure. Suppose you are hiking in the forest. As you come over a steep hill, you discover that there is a blazing forest fire headed your way. Since fire is painful and potentially deadly, you would avoid the fire at all costs and thereby increase your chances of survival. The naturalistic explanation for this is obvious. If human beings are the products of evolution by natural selection, we would expect physical pain to aid survival. But of course, not all physical pain and pleasure is biologically useful. For example, consider the following description of the pain and suffering caused by Ebola. Within days of infection, Ebola patients suffer from soaring temperature and excruciating joint and muscle pain. The throat is so sore that swallowing anything, including one's own saliva, is intolerable. The skin becomes like soft bread. It can be spread apart with one's fingers and blood oozes out. Victims choke as the sloughed-off surfaces of their tongues and throats slide into their windpipes. Every body orifice bleeds. Even the eyeballs fill with blood that leaks down the cheeks. In the final stages, victims become convulsive, splashing blood all around as they twitch, shake, and thrash to their deaths. Ebola, according to science writer Richard Preston, is a perfect parasite because it transforms virtually every part of the body into a digested slime of virus particles. If there is a God, don't you think he could let Ebola victims suffer just a little bit less? If we had the power to do so, we would immediately alleviate their suffering. After all, if theism is true, God could fine-tune humans so that they experience pain only when it is necessary for some greater good. But if they're going to die anyway, what possible reason could God have for letting Ebola victims experience such agonizing pain until death? The chances that such a reason would intersect with the biological goal of survival, well, it's pretty slim. On naturalism, however, we would expect people to feel pain, even when the pain will not aid in survival. Evolution by natural selection is not an intelligent process. On naturalism, there seems to be no way for creatures to have evolved so that they only feel pain when it will aid survival. Therefore, the biological role of pain and pleasure is more likely on naturalism than theism, and that's my third reason for believing that naturalism is true. Number four, naturalism offers the best explanation for the flourishing and languishing of sentient beings. Only a fraction of living things, including the majority of sentient beings, thrive. In other words, very few living things have an adequate supply of food and water, are able to reproduce, avoid predators, and remain healthy. An even smaller fraction of organisms thrive for most of their lives, and almost no organisms thrive for all of their lives. If naturalistic evolution is true, this is what we'd expect. If all living things are in competition for limited resources, then the majority of those organisms will not survive long enough to thrive. Moreover, even those organisms that do thrive for much of their lives will, if they live long enough, deteriorate. As Paul Draper says, quote, "A Darwinian world is inevitably cruel, especially to the young, the old, and the genetically less fortunate," end quote. However, if theism is true, why would God create a world in which all sentient beings savagely compete with one another for survival? Does anyone really believe that there could be a moral justification for this? The fact that so few sentient beings ever flourish is therefore more likely on naturalism than on theism. Number five, naturalism offers the best explanation for tragedies. On May 2nd of this year, there was a terrible accident involving a bus packed with members of a church youth group. Six girls and one man died as a result. What makes this a tragedy is that, as far as we can tell, no outweighing good came from this accident. I think all of us can probably think of other examples of tragedy in this sense. Yet, if theism is true, God could prevent tragedies in many different ways, ways that would not take away our free will or our ability to develop moral character. For example, God could have prevented the recent earthquake in Turkey or the flood here in North Carolina without taking away anyone's moral freedom. And despite centuries of theological reflection by some of the greatest minds in history, most theistic philosophers now admit they have absolutely no idea why God allows tragedies like the church bus accident, the earthquake in Turkey, or the flood here in North Carolina to happen. Alvin Plantinga of Notre Dame University, a Christian philosopher who has attempted to defend theism against the problem of evil, admits, quote, "Many of the attempts to explain why God permits evil seem to me shallow, tepid, and ultimately frivolous." Of course, it's logically possible that God has a reason for allowing tragedies, a reason we mere humans don't understand. But it's also logically possible that God has extra reasons for preventing tragedies, reasons we also do not understand. Clearly, then, tragedies are improbable on theism. But if naturalism is true, there are no supernatural beings who care about our suffering. Thus, we would expect tragedies, and therefore tragedies are some evidence for naturalism and against theism. Number six, naturalism offers the best explanation for God's silence in the face of tragedies. Imagine you have a three-year-old son with leukemia, and you have to bring him to the hospital twice a week to receive extremely painful chemotherapy treatments. In this case, his pain is for a greater good. The chemotherapy might actually save his life. But your son cries his eyes out every time you bring him to the hospital because the treatments are so painful. Although you try to explain to him why the chemotherapy is necessary, he just doesn't understand. So instead, you simply comfort him and remind him often that you love him. Just as loving parents would comfort their son while he was fighting leukemia, we would expect a loving God to comfort human beings who suffer as the result of tragedies. If theism is true, then God loves his creatures and wants all of his creatures to love him in return. However, many people find it hard to love God when they do not understand the reasons for their suffering and God seems so far away. In other words, even if God has a reason for allowing tragedies, he could at least comfort victims of suffering so that they know he loves him. Yet there are many, many victims of tragedies who report not feeling God's comforting presence, and this includes theists. This is not at all what we would expect if theism were true. However, if naturalism is true, we would expect victims of tragedy not to experience God's comforting presence for the simple reason that there is no God. Thus, God's silence in the face of tragedies is much more probable on naturalism than on theism. Number 7, naturalism offers the best explanation for the variety of theistic claims worldwide. Religious believers hold a wide variety of beliefs about the supernatural and the nature of God. Besides Christianity, there are many other religions, including Judaism, Islam, Hinduism, and Buddhism, to name just a few. All of these world religions make different claims about the nature of God and about the religious path God wants us to take. Now, let's suppose that you are an open-minded theist trying to decide which religious path to follow. Why should you choose one religious path over another? The answer to that question, well, it's far from obvious, right? But all this is pretty strange if theism is true. On theism, we would expect God to clearly reveal his plan for salvation so that there would be no confusion about which religious path to take. On naturalism, however, there is no God, and therefore no reason to expect religious believers to agree on anything. Thus, religious confusion is evidence for naturalism and against theism. Number 8, naturalism offers the best explanation for the reasonableness of non-belief. Suppose I told you that there was a woman named Jane who claims she is your long-lost sister, and she really wants to meet you. Days, weeks, even months go by, but you never actually meet her or even hear from her. You never get a letter, a phone call, a fax, an email message, a page, no blimp advertisements, absolutely nothing from her. In fact, the only evidence of her existence is that I claim she exists. Why haven't you heard from her? Well, maybe Jane's shy. She wants to meet you, but she's too embarrassed. Or maybe Jane's busy. She wants to get together with you, but she's a single mom working two full-time jobs just to make ends meet and doesn't have the time to meet with you. Just as you might be curious to meet Jane, there are many people, including myself, who don't believe in God, but who wish that some sort of a theistic God did exist. Now, the Apostle Paul in Romans 1 says that the existence of God is just obvious to everyone, even atheists and agnostics. But just think about that for a second. How do you prove that something is obvious to another person? Lots of non-believers claim that the existence of God is not obvious to them. Indeed, many non-believers claim that it is just obvious that it is not obvious that God exists. Why is this evidence for naturalism over theism? Because if theism is true, we would expect non-belief in God to be unreasonable. Whatever reasons Jane may have for not revealing herself to you do not apply to God. God is not shy. God is not busy, and so forth. But if naturalism is true, there is no God, and we would expect non-belief to be reasonable. Therefore, I think reasonable non-belief is more likely on naturalism than on theism, and that's my 8th line of evidence for naturalism. So in sum, we've seen 8 lines of evidence that naturalism is true. If Dr. Fernandez wants to believe theism instead, then he's got to provide evidence of his own for theism and then show why that evidence outweighs all of the evidence for naturalism which I've given. Unless he does that, I think it's pretty clear that the evidence points towards naturalism.
I'd like to express my gratitude to Anthony Battaglia for arranging this debate and my good friend Jeff Louder for agreeing to debate me. I have chosen to utilize a cumulative case for God This cumulative case will examine several different aspects of human experience that are more adequately explained by theism, the belief in a personal God, than by naturalism, the rejection of the belief in a personal God. The thesis I seek to defend is as follows. It is more reasonable to be a theist than it is to be an atheist. For purposes of this debate, I will define God as the eternal, uncaused cause of all else that exists. This being is personal, i.e., a moral and intelligent being, and unlimited in all his attributes. This being is separate from his creation, transcendent, but he is also involved with it, immanent. In short, I will argue that the God of theism exists. Number one, the beginning of the universe. This argument is as follows. Whatever began to exist must have a cause. The universe began to exist, therefore the universe had a cause. Premise number one uses the law of causality. Non-being cannot cause being. In other words, from nothing, nothing comes. Since nothing is nothing, it can do nothing. Therefore, it can cause nothing. Hence, whatever began to exist needs a cause for its existence. Premise number two contends that the universe had a beginning. Scientific evidence for the beginning of the universe includes the second law of thermodynamics, also known as energy deterioration, and the Big Bang model. The second law of thermodynamics is one of the most firmly established laws of modern science. It states that the amount of usable energy in a closed system is running down. This means that someday in the finite future, all the energy in the universe will be useless unless there is intervention from outside the universe. In other words, if left to itself, the universe will have an end. But if the universe is going to have an end, it had to have a beginning. At one time in the finite past, all the energy in the universe was usable. Since the universe is winding down, it must have been wound up. The universe is not eternal. It had a beginning. Since it had a beginning, it needs a cause, for from nothing, nothing comes. Due to energy deterioration, if the universe is eternal, it would have reached a state of equilibrium in which no change is possible an infinite amount of time ago. All of the universe's energy would already have been used up. Obviously, this is not the case. Therefore, the universe had a beginning. The Big Bang model also indicates that the universe had a beginning. In 1929, astronomer Edwin Hubble discovered that the universe is expanding at the same rate in all directions. As time moves forward, the universe is growing apart. But this means that if we go back in time, the physical universe would get smaller and smaller. Eventually, if we go back far enough in the past, the entire universe would be what scientists call a point of infinite density, or a point of dimensionless space. However, if something is infinitely dense, it is non-existent, for existent things can only be finitely small. The same can be said for points of dimensionless space. If a point has no dimensions, it is non-existent, for it takes up no space. Of course, we're talking about the physical universe. If a point has no dimensions, it is non-existent, for it takes up no space. Therefore, if the Big Bang model is correct, it shows that the universe began out of nothing a finite time ago. There have been two main attempts to refute the beginning of the universe. The first is called the steady state model. This view holds that the universe never had a beginning. Because of the mounting evidence for the Big Bang model, this view has been abandoned by most of its adherents. Second attempt to evade the beginning of the universe is called the oscillating model. This model teaches that at some point during the universe's expansion, gravity will halt the expansion and pull everything back together again. From that point, there will be another Big Bang. This process will be repeated over and over again throughout all eternity. However, the oscillating model fails. First, there is no known principle of physics that would reverse the collapse of the universe and cause another Big Bang. Second, scientific research has shown that the universe is not dense enough for gravity to pull it back together again. And third, even if it could be proven that several Big Bangs have occurred, the second law of thermodynamics would still require that there was a first Big Bang and therefore a last Big Bang. Many scientists accept the beginning of the universe but believe that it does not need a cause. The evidence proposed by these scientists consists of speculation dealing with quantum physics, the study of subatomic particles. Appeal is made to Heisenberg's principle of indeterminacy in order to claim that quantum particles pop into existence out of nothing entirely without a cause. However, Heisenberg's principle does not necessitate such an absurd interpretation. Simply because scientists cannot presently find the causes for quantum events does not mean that the causes do not exist. All that Heisenberg's principle states is that scientists are presently unable to accurately and simultaneously measure both the position and the momentum of a subatomic particle. If this principle proved that events can occur without causes, then this would destroy one of the pillars of modern science, the principle of causality. Every event must have an adequate cause. It seems obvious to me that the principle of causality is on firmer epistemological ground than the belief that things can pop into existence without a cause. Non-being cannot cause being. The universe had a beginning, then it needs a cause. Besides the scientific evidence, there is also philosophical evidence for the beginning of the universe. If the universe is eternal, then there would be an actual infinite number of events in time. However, as Zeno's paradoxes have shown, it is impossible to traverse an actual infinite set of points. If we assume the existence of an infinite amount of actual points between two locations, and that's a big assumption, then we can never get from location A to location B. Since no matter how many points we have traversed, there will still be an infinite number of points left. If the universe is eternal, then there must exist an actual infinite set of events in the past, but then it would be impossible to reach the present moment. Since the present moment has been reached, there cannot be an actual infinite set of events in the past. There could only be a finite number. Therefore, there had to be a first event. Hence, the universe had a beginning. It should also be noted that if it is possible for an actual infinite set to exist outside of mind, contradictions and absurdities would be generated. To illustrate this point, let's look at two infinite sets. Set A consists of all numbers, both odd and even. But set B contains only all the odd numbers. Set A and set B are equal since they both have an infinite number of members. Still, set A has twice the number of members as set B, since set A contains both odd and even numbers, while set B contains only odd numbers. It is a clear contradiction to say that set A and set B have an equal amount of members, while set A has twice as many members as set B. Therefore, actual infinite sets cannot exist outside the mind. Actual sets existing outside the mind can only be potentially infinite, not actually infinite. These sets can be added to indefinitely. Still, we will never reach an actual infinite by successive addition. Therefore, the universe cannot have an actual infinite number of events in the past. The universe had a beginning. Since the universe had to have a beginning, it had to have a cause. For from nothing, nothing comes. But if the universe needs a cause, what if the cause of the universe also needs a cause? Could we not have an infinite chain of causes and effects stretching backwards in time throughout all eternity? Obviously, the answer is no. For we have already shown that an actual infinite set existing outside of a mind is impossible. Therefore, an infinite chain of causes and effects is also impossible. There had to be a first uncaused cause of the universe. This uncaused cause would be eternal, without beginning or end. Only eternal and uncaused existence can ground the existence of the universe. Several attributes of the uncaused cause of the universe can be discovered through examination of the universe. This debate hopefully is evidence that intelligent life exists in the universe. Since intelligence is a perfection found in the universe, the ultimate cause of the universe must also be an intelligent being, for intelligence cannot come from non-intelligence. No one has ever shown how intelligence could evolve from mindless nature. Morality also exists in the universe, for without morality, there would be no such thing as right and wrong. However, the moral judgments we make show that we do believe there are such things as right and wrong. Still, nature is non-moral. No one holds a rock morally responsible for tripping them. There is no way that mere molecules in motion could produce moral values. Since nature is non-moral, but morality exists in the universe, the cause of the universe must be a moral being. Therefore, the uncaused cause of the universe must be an intelligent, moral being. This means that God must be a personal being. Number two, the continuing existence of the universe. Experience shows us that limited dependent beings exist. These limited dependent beings need other beings for their continued existence. For example, I depend on air, water, and food to sustain my existence. However, adding limited dependent beings will never give us an independent and unlimited whole. Therefore, the sum total of limited dependent beings is itself limited and dependent. If each individual part of a floor is wood, then the whole floor will be wood. Likewise, if each part of the universe is dependent, then the entire universe is dependent. Hence, the ultimate cause of the continuing existence of all dependent, limited dependent beings must be unlimited and independent. There cannot be two or more unlimited and independent beings, since if there were, they would limit one another's existence, but then they would not be unlimited. Therefore, there can only be one unlimited and independent being. This being must have all its attributes in an unlimited way, otherwise it could not be an unlimited being. This being must be all-powerful, for he is the source of all the power in the universe. No other power can limit him. He is eternal, for he is not limited by time. He is everywhere present, since he is not limited by space. He is immaterial, since he is not limited by matter. This being must be all good, since he is not limited by evil. He must also be all knowing, since he is not limited by ignorance. Since mindless nature works towards goals, such as acorns always becoming oak trees and not something else, there must be an intelligent designer overseeing natural processes. Without intelligent design, nature's processes would be left to chance. There would be no orderly patterns that could be described as natural laws. Therefore, this infinite and independent being, whom all finite independent beings depend upon for their continued existence, must be an intelligent being. Number three, the design and order found in the universe. The order, design, and complexity found in the universe strongly imply that the universe is not a random, chaotic throwing together of atoms. Rather, it is the product of intelligent design. And as the product of intelligent design, it necessitates the existence of an intelligent designer. Contemporary scientists have found numerous evidences for design in the universe. A few examples will suffice. First, the slightest variation in the expansion rate of the universe would render the universe incapable of sustaining life. Second, British scientists, or former evolutionists, Hoyle and Wickramasinghe, estimated that the chances of life evolving from the random shuffling of organic molecules is virtually zero. They calculated that there is only one chance in 10 to the 20th power to form a single enzyme, and just one chance in 10 to the 40,000 power to produce the approximately 2,000 enzymes that exist. However, Hoyle and Wickramasinghe point out that the production of enzymes is only one step in the generation of life. Therefore, they concluded there must be some type of cosmic intelligence to explain the origin of life. Hoyle compared the probability of life spontaneously generating from non-life as equivalent to the chances of a tornado randomly producing a Boeing 747 from a junkyard. The cell is the basic unit of life. The DNA molecule of a single-celled animal contains enough genetic information, complex information, to fill one volume of an encyclopedia. An explosion in a print shop will never produce one volume of an encyclopedia by chance. That amount of information necessitates an intelligent cause. Also, the human brain contains more genetic information than the information found in the world's largest libraries. There is no way that this amount of information could be produced by mere chance. Intelligent intervention is needed. Third, astrophysicist Hugh Ross listed 25 narrowly defined parameters that the universe had to have in order for life to be possible. Ross also pointed out 32 narrowly defined parameters for life concerning the Earth, its moon, its sun, and its galaxy. For instance, if the distance between the Earth and the sun was to differ by just 2% in either direction, no life on Earth would be possible. These parameters for life on Earth clearly show evidence of design and purpose. Fourth, molecular biologist Michael Behe has shown that the irreducible complexity found on the molecular level cannot be explained by the atheistic evolutionary model. Intelligent design is the only adequate explanation. The theistic hypothesis of intelligent design is obviously more plausible than the atheistic hypotheses of random chance. Number four, the existence of absolute moral values. We all make moral value judgments when we call the actions of another person wrong. When we do this, we appeal to moral law. This moral law could not originate with each individual, for then we could not call the actions of another person, such as Adolf Hitler, wrong. The moral law is not a creation of each society, for then one society cannot call the actions of another society, such as Nazi Germany, wrong. The moral law does not come from a world consensus, for world consensus is often mistaken. The world once thought that the earth was flat, the sun revolved around the earth, and slavery was morally acceptable. Appealing to society or world consensus will never give us an adequate cause for the moral law and the moral judgments we make. Appealing to society or world consensus only quantitatively adds men and women. What we need is a moral law qualitatively above man. This moral law must be eternal and unchanging so that we can condemn the actions of the past, i.e. slavery, the Holocaust, etc. The moral law qualitatively above man is not descriptive of the way things are, as is the case with natural laws. The moral law must be prescriptive. It prescribes the way things ought to be. Prescriptive laws need a prescriber. Therefore, a moral lawgiver must exist, and this lawgiver must be eternal and unchanging. Number five, the absurdity of life without God. What hope can an atheist offer mankind? People on their deathbeds don't usually call an atheist to comfort them. Normally, a preacher or priest is summoned. Even if an atheist could guarantee us 70 years of happiness, what good would that be when compared with the eternity of non-existence that follows? If there is no God, then Hitler will not be punished for his evil deeds, and Mother Teresa will not be rewarded for her generous works of charity. If there is no God, then a million years from now, it would make no difference if you were a Hitler or a Mother Teresa. Can life have any ultimate meaning if there is no God? If non-existence is what awaits us, can we really make sense of life? You live, and then you die. There are no eternal consequences. Hitler and Mother Teresa have the same destiny. We all finish our meaningless journeys in total nothingness. The famous atheist Bertrand Russell admitted that man is the product of causes which had no prevision of the end they were achieving, that his origins, his growth, his hopes and fears, his loves and his beliefs are but the outcome of accidental collocations of atoms, that no fire, no heroism, no intensity of thought and feeling can preserve an individual life beyond the grave, that all the labors of the ages, all the devotion, all the inspiration, all the noonday brightness of human genius are destined to extinction in the vast death of the solar system, and that the whole temple of man's achievement must inevitably be buried beneath the debris of a universe in ruins. Immediately following that statement, Russell referred to his atheistic philosophy as the firm foundation of unyielding despair. Why have conferences if that's the case? Without God, life is without meaning. However, if there is a God, then there is hope. The God of the Bible guarantees the defeat of evil and the triumph of good. He guarantees that Hitler will receive his punishment and Mother Teresa will receive her reward. God gives life meaning. For how we choose to live our lives on earth brings eternal consequences. God is our reason to be optimistic about the future. Only He can overcome our fear of death. Only He can defeat evil. Without God, meaningless existence is all we face. Without God, there is no hope. Number six, the failure of naturalism. I have shown that naturalism cannot adequately explain the beginning of the universe, its continuing existence, design found in the universe, or the existence of absolute moral values. Naturalism cannot give meaning to life, but there are more problems for naturalism, for it cannot adequately explain the laws of logic and mathematics, though both are needed for scientific investigation to begin. Naturalism has no way to justify the sanctity of human life. It cannot offer a plausible explanation for human free will and human responsibility. In conclusion, theism is more reasonable than naturalism. Naturalism either tries to explain away the aspects of reality we have discussed, or it acknowledges these aspects of reality but says they are just there. Naturalism becomes either an explaining away of the evidence or a total non-explanation, whereas theism offers a reasonable explanation of the evidence. Hence, theism is more reasonable than naturalism. Thank you.
I want to make three general comments about Dr. Fernandez's case and then address specific arguments. First, his argument about the alleged absurdity of life without God is really nothing more than an appeal to emotion, and I would say irrelevant in a debate about evidence. Second, his arguments about morality, the sanctity of human life, are just versions of the same argument, and so they're not truly independent of one another. Third, I don't think Dr. Fernandez has provided us with a cumulative case for theism. In order for his case to be cumulative, each argument must independently support the God of theism and not just some supernatural being in general. But by his own admission, most of his own arguments do not show that a moral or personal God exists. I'll have more to say about this a little bit later on. Let's turn then to some of his arguments, to all of his arguments for theism. His first argument was that the beginning of the universe supports the existence of God. And I have three responses. First, naturalists who accept the Big Bang model do not believe that the universe just popped into existence out of nothing. Rather, they believe that there was no time at which the universe did not exist, and there is no place the universe came from. On naturalism, the universe just is, and that's all. Second, there is no reason to believe the universe has a cause. The kernel of truth in my opponent's argument is that anything which begins to exist in space and time must have a cause. Naturalists are willing to accept that. However, the origin of the universe is not an event in space and time. Rather, at least if the Big Bang theory is true, the origin of the universe is the very origin of space and time itself. And Dr. Fernandez has given us no reason to believe that has a cause. Third, what's the theistic alternative? That somebody could make a universe out of absolutely nothing? That a being who exists outside of time could magically cause time itself to exist? The theistic explanation is no better than the naturalistic explanation, and maybe worse. As for the continuing existence of the universe, I think that Dr. Fernandez has committed the fallacy of composition. Just because parts of the universe are dependent in some sense, it doesn't follow that the universe as a whole is dependent. In fact, I have to confess, I just don't see what he's getting at here. Naturalists who accept the Big Bang theory believe that the universe is only about, say, 15 billion years old, and it's not going to go on forever. It's going to run down eventually. So what's the problem? It's not like we're talking about some independently eternal object. I'd like to hear more explanation from Dr. Fernandez on that point. I simply don't see the problem. I'm therefore going to go on to his next argument, the argument to design. And I have three responses to that. First, why should we believe that either fine-tuning or the origin of life is improbable on naturalism? Consider the parameters of our universe which allow life. How does Dr. Fernandez know what their probability is? Stephen Sue, a physicist at Yale specializing in theoretical particle physics, says, quote, "This stuff is nonsense. The number these people cite are pulled out of thin air. Really, we don't have the slightest idea how likely or unlikely the universe is." Or take the origin of life. The odds he gave are flawed because they assume a random process. The naturalist claims that the origin of life was the result of non-random, deterministic laws. Second, why should we believe that either fine-tuning or life is likely on theism? Just because God exists doesn't mean he wants to design either the first cell or a universe capable of sustaining life. And if God did decide to create a world with life, don't you think he could have done a better job? As my arguments for naturalism show, our universe leaves much to be desired. Third, Occam's razor comes into play here. Even if these things were unlikely on naturalism, and I don't think they are, that wouldn't mean we need to explain the known in terms of the unknown. Maybe there are many universes, and ours is the only universe that allows life. Maybe life began on another planet 12 billion years ago and was transported to Earth on a meteor. I don't actually believe any of these things. That's not the point. The point is that all other things held equal, the alleged fine-tuning, as well as the origin of life, are not evidence for theism and against naturalism. And number four, he brought up the example of Michael Behe's book on irreducible complexity. I simply don't think there are any irreducibly complex systems. To say that a biological system is irreducibly complex assumes that if the system was missing a part, it could not have been functional in any environment for any reason. But a predecessor to that system could lack a part and yet still be functional because some part of its environment is different than the environment of its descendant. In fact, this is precisely what the naturalist claims happened. What Fernandez calls irreducibly complex systems evolved indirectly from systems that perform slightly or very different functions in our ancestors. Given how little we know about ancestors, how could Fernandez possibly show that precursors could not have performed different functions in our ancestors? Biochemistry is very young and very complicated, and I just think this is a totally premature conclusion for him to draw. Thus, if evolution is true, we shouldn't expect to know how such systems evolved, at least not yet. His next argument for theism was the moral law, and I just want to make two comments very briefly. First, objective morality is logically compatible with naturalism. Indeed, Richard Swinburne, arguably the most influential Christian philosopher today, says that, and I quote, if morality is objective, the naturalistic account of it is correct, and morality is based on a set of logically necessary truths. Second, God's commands could create moral obligations if and only if there is an already existing moral obligation to obey God's commands. Thus, even if God exists, there is at least one moral obligation, the obligation to obey God, that holds independently of God, and therefore this is no evidence for theism. Turning again very briefly to his argument about the alleged absurdity of life without God, I've already shown that this is irrelevant. Again, I just want to emphasize the topic of our debate is naturalism versus theism. Which way does the evidence point? We are not here to discuss naturalism versus theism, which view makes us happy. After all, just because a statement is depressing does not make it false, and therefore I just think this is irrelevant. But he says, how can there be any ultimate meaning? And I think that this, even though I think that this is technically irrelevant to the topic of our debate, I want to address this because I know that this is a question many people have. And I want to say that Dr. Fernandez is absolutely right that if there is no God, life would have no ultimate meaning. But just because life has no ultimate meaning does not mean that it is meaningless. Even if there is no purpose of life, there can still be purpose in life. In fact, this is widely recognized even by Dr. Fernandez's counterparts in the Society of Christian Philosophers, Michael Peterson, Bruce Hasker, or William Hasker, Bruce Reichenbach, and David Basinger point out in their book published by Oxford University Press, Rationality and Religious Belief, I think is the title of it. They say, quote, the burden of proof clearly lies with the believer. What the believer must establish is that non-believers who deny cosmic, or as I call it, ultimate meaning, but still claim to possess personal meaning, are not justified in maintaining this position. And Dr. Fernandez hasn't even come close to showing that. As they go on to say, quote, there appears to be no widespread scientific, psychological, or physiological, or logical support for the claim that one cannot justifiably claim to have personal meaning if one denies cosmic meaning, end quote. And I think this is just apparent if you look at the lives of some of the more famous non-theists, like Bertrand Russell. Is Phil Fernandez actually going to say that Bertrand Russell had a meaningless life? I'm sorry, I just don't buy that. That seems absolutely absurd to me. I think it's quite obvious that Bertrand Russell and several other non-theists have had very meaningful lives. It may not have been ultimately meaningful in a theistic sense, but it was clearly meaningful. And in fact, that reminds me, he quoted Bertrand Russell, who talked about a life built upon the firm foundation of unyielding despair. And I think it's important to point out the context of that quotation is not what my opponent thinks it was. Russell was talking about the meaning of life given theistic expectations. Russell said that life is meaningless in a religious sense, but he went on to say that life is meaningful in an ethical sense. And if this is interesting or confusing or both to you, I would recommend Quentin Smith's book, Ethical and Religious Thought, where he explains this in great detail. So I completely disagree with the way that Bertrand Russell's been quoted in tonight's debate. His next and final point was the failure of naturalism, and I understand that in an opening statement you're only supposed to give arguments for your position and you wait until your rebuttal to refute the evidence that your opponent gives, but I do have to say I think it was a bit premature to say the failure of naturalism when he hadn't yet addressed my arguments. But he went on to say, yeah, but if naturalism is true, how could you have the laws of logic or the laws of mathematics? Well, how could you not? I can't even comprehend what it would mean to say that the law of non-contradiction doesn't hold. That just doesn't even make sense. He says, well, what about the sanctity of human life? Well, here's the fundamental difference in naturalistic worldviews and, I would say, theistic worldviews. The naturalist could say that human life is special, but if he did, it would not be special in the sense that most theists, at least in my experience, say that it's special. In fact, I misplaced my notes on this point, but basically the point I wanted to make is, in my experience, theists typically say that humans are the only moral agents, and the fact that other animals can experience pain has no moral significance, whereas I don't want to speak for all naturalists, but I would say that on naturalism, human life is not special in that sense. Yes, humans are the only moral agents, but other animals are capable of feeling pain, and that is morally significant. They can't be held responsible for the decisions they make, but humans, as moral agents, do have some sort of an obligation to take that into account in how we treat them. As for free will, I'd like to hear more explanation on that point also. He hasn't really given an argument for theism. He just says that we can't account for free will. Look, he's got the burden of proof here. If he wants to say that free will provides evidence for theism, then he needs to explain that. Take that into account, add in the 8 arguments for naturalism which I gave that haven't been addressed, and I think it's pretty clear the evidence still supports naturalism and not theism. Thank you.
Okay, I'd like to state a few things. Jeff listed 8 areas where he believed that 8 lines of evidence for naturalism is what he referred to them as. He said that naturalism provides the best evidence for the physical cause of minds or the mind's dependency on the physical. In this present state of existence, I know of no theist who would argue that the immaterial mind is in some way dependent upon the physical brain, okay? But that's not the issue. The issue is there an immaterial mind? So he's really not addressing that. He's missing the point. Also like to refer to the research of Habermas and Moreland, Christian philosophers, their work, Immortality, the Other Side of Death. They discussed the results of recent brain research independently by several scientists who were of the naturalistic mindset. Wilder Penfield, Roger Sperry, Hans Kuhnhuber, and B. Leibniz. Their research seems to indicate that human decision-making processes occur apart from the brain, though it does affect brain state. They basically learned to prod certain areas of the human brain and get people to raise their right hand, and they would ask the people, well, what happened? They thought the people were going to say, I decided to raise my right hand, and I did. And instead, the people responded, you raised my right hand. And so it seems to at least imply that the decision-making doesn't occur in the brain. Decision-making occurs somewhere else and acts upon the brain. But I would agree with him that the present state of the mind is somewhat dependent upon the brain, but that doesn't prove naturalism one bit. Number 2, he talked about that naturalism is the best explanation for the relationship between the simple and complex life forms, and he mentioned the fossil record as that being the place where you would find that evidence. Well, Dr. Colin Patterson, senior principal scientific officer of the paleontology department of the British Museum of Natural History in London, in a personal letter to Dr. Sunderland, dated April 10, 1979, stated this, and Patterson is one of the world's foremost experts on the fossil record. He is an atheistic evolutionist, and he stated this: I fully agree with your comments on the lack of direct illustration of evolutionary transitions in my book. If I knew of any fossil or living, I would certainly have included them. Yet Gould and the American Museum people are hard to contradict when they say there are no transitional forms. You say that I should at least show a photo of the fossil from which each type of organism is derived. I will lay it on the line. There is not one such fossil for which one could make a watertight argument. Now, he continues to believe his atheistic evolution, but here's the foremost expert on the fossil record, and he admits that the evidence is not there, whereas Jeff is claiming that it is. And this idea, the lowest levels are simple, and then you get more complex as you go on, that's the rule. Well, there's probably as many exceptions to the rule as there are rules. It took millions of years for these layers to form. One wonders how these exceptions took place. One wonders about the problem of polystrate fossils, trees growing through several layers that supposedly took millions of years to form. So I don't think you're going to find the evidence for evolution in the fossil record. He mentioned molecular biology. Michael Behe's work there, and by the way, Dawkins has been asked to debate Michael Behe and has turned him down, and I think it's a good decision. Michael Behe is a microbiologist. He's the associate professor of biochemistry at Lehigh University, and he argues that the irreducible complexity of subcellular organic structures shows that they could not have evolved. He gives several examples from psyllium, what he says that there's a structure that some cells use to swim in, blood clotting, how cells transport materials from one subcellular compartment to another, the origin of the immune system, the intricate system required by the cell to make just one of its building blocks. Behe argues that these molecular mechanisms are comprised of many parts that interact in complex ways, and that no single part can function usefully unless all the other parts are present. And then he argues that there's no way that these systems could be produced step by step, and therefore these molecular mechanisms are designed, and he compares them with the design of spaceships and computers. Now, this is a guy coming from the evolutionist camp. He is right now a theistic evolutionist, so this is not your special creationist camp, but he seems to be the expert in the field that secular humanists need to dialogue with if they want to make that case. Jeff mentioned things like pain and pleasure, and he focused on Ebola victims, unnecessary pain and suffering, and why does God allow Ebola victims to, why doesn't he allow them to suffer less? He talks about tragedies such as the church, youth group, the bus, and several died, and no good could come out of this, but Jeff is an infinitely wise being. So I don't see how he could say that no good can come out of this. God often uses tragedies to draw people to himself so they don't fall in love with this present life, so that they hope for a hereafter. In fact, Blaise Pascal went on to argue that the only good thing about this present life, and he's overemphasizing his point, but the only good thing about this present life is the hope of another life after this one. But God often uses suffering to draw people to himself. In fact, William Lane Craig has basically stated that evangelical Christianity is experiencing its most rapid and sustained growth in countries that are experiencing intense suffering. An example he gives is El Salvador, where over 80% of the population live in poverty. 1960, only 2.3% of the population were evangelicals. Now, well over 20% of the population are evangelicals. Same could be said about China, the Philippines, Ethiopia. And so it seems that God uses suffering to draw people to himself so that they would not be all caught up in this present life. Jesus of Nazareth said, man does not live on bread alone, but on every utterance of the mouth of God. We fell, according to Christian theism, we fell in the garden. Things aren't the way they ought to be. And that the only solution to the problem of evil, and by the way, the problem of evil is just not a hypothetical problem, and I'd like to hear a definition of it from Jeff. How does the atheist define evil? Because how do you define a crooked line unless you have some concept of a straight line? What is evil unless it's the perversion of something that is ultimately good? Okay? So I think atheism has a problem defining evil, number one. Number two,
even if the atheist admits that evil is real, and if you don't, then I think Christian theism is superior. Christian theism can look at the Ebola sufferer and say that is a product of evil. That's not the way things ought to be. If the atheist can't call that evil, then I think the Christian is on higher moral ground right there to be able to say that is really evil. That's number one. But number two, if the atheist admits that evil is real, what solution do you have for it? Seems to me that in the end, if Bertrand Russell is right, if atheism is right, then evil and human suffering wins. The universe dies. And I think the Apostle Paul was onto something when he said, if the dead are not raised, if there's no life after death, then let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we die. Which makes me wonder why so many secular humanists come together and have this driving force in life to better the world. Hey, this world's going to blow up and cease to exist if you guys are right. Now, if the God of the Bible exists, and he said that I would say Bertrand Russell's life was not meaningful. I believe it was very meaningful, because I believe this life is a test. I believe that human beings are eternal beings. I believe that the things we do in this life will have eternal consequences. So I do believe that Bertrand Russell's life was meaningful. However, by Bertrand Russell's own words, I think we see that there was no ultimate meaning for his life, if his views were correct. But my problem is, if there's no ultimate meaning, well, what's the big deal? I mean, it was basically you make a lot of money, you feed a lot of people, you build a lot of buildings, and then eventually the whole universe dies. If there's no ultimate meaning, it seems to me being proud of finding meaning in buying a brand new Corvette or helping somebody in need, in the end, it didn't amount to anything. So I think this is more than appeal to emotion here. I think this is something very important. And I think when atheists get together and have a passion to argue against the existence of the God of the Bible, I think they're actually living inconsistently with their belief system, and they'd be more consistent if they just say, well, let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we die. So I think if there's no meaning with a capital M, then you can take all the meanings with little m's and just toss them aside, because in the end, total non-existence, that's all there is. And religious confusions. This seems to create the fallacy if they all disagree, they must all be wrong. Okay? In fact, I would agree with the 1961 Turceso versus Watkins Supreme Court decision that even secular humanism is in some sense religious. So if you want to say Christianity and the other religions all disagree, therefore they must all be false, we'll throw atheism in there too. But the fact of the matter is, just because you got five guys who disagree on something doesn't mean they're all wrong. One of them might be right. Now, I provided some real good evidence that theism is correct. He disagrees, yet disagrees with me, but I think I've made a really good case. Let me just talk a little bit about my case. The origin of the universe, there's only a few options here. Either the universe is eternal. When the Big Bang model popped on the scene, that was a defeat for atheism. And I would like to see more honest atheists admit that, or agnostics admit that, like Robert Jastrow, who said that when scientists have scaled the highest mountains, they got there and found a band of theologians waiting for them for several centuries. Okay? I would like to see a little bit more honesty on that. When science showed that the universe had a beginning, that was a defeat. Not a victory, a defeat for atheism. So throw out the eternal universe. And then this idea that the universe popped into existence totally without a cause, he says that atheists don't hold to that. I heard it from Quentin Smith's mouth. And Quentin Smith is one of the leading atheist philosophers today. In fact, Jeff attended that as well. Others would argue maybe it had a beginning, but it caused its own beginning. That's impossible. That's absurd. For something to cause its own existence, it would have to pre-exist its own existence in order to bring its own existence about. Okay? Many pantheists would argue the universe is not an illusion. I don't think we need to debate that point. I think we're both in the same camp here, that there is a real universe. And so I think that by far the evidence points in the favor of the universe being caused to exist by an eternal, uncaused cause.
Oh, Okay, once again, I'd like to begin by going through Dr. Fernandez's case for theism and then turn to my case for naturalism. First, I made the point that that some of his case seems to me to be nothing more than an appeal to emotion. I said that the alleged absurdity of life without God is nothing more than an appeal to emotion, and I'm going to deal with that when I get into his case. We didn't really hear, or at least I didn't, anything at all in his last speech about morality or the sanctity of human life. And I actually didn't hear anything at all about my argument that his case is not a cumulative case for theism. I just think this is obvious. I don't think that each of his arguments establishes the God of theism. Yeah, if they were true, they would show that some sort of supernatural being exists, but that's not the same thing as theism. And so he doesn't have a cumulative case for theism. Of course, if that's all I said, it would still be possible that naturalism wasn't true either. I need to refute some of the arguments that he's given to be able to maintain that naturalism is true, and I want to do that right now. He says that the beginning of the universe was a victory for theism. I couldn't disagree more with that. I think this sounds like the sort of thing that John Templeton's money machine has made possible. The amount of research he's pumped into books and newspaper articles claiming that science has found God. Nothing's really happened new in science. Yeah, we now believe that the Big Bang Theory is true, but it's not like we have any new substantive evidence. When I believed in God, the last time I debated Dr. Fernandez, I believed in God. I was a theistic evolutionist. I believed in Big Bang cosmology then. Then I became an agnostic, and I still believe Big Bang cosmology. And now I'm an atheist and a naturalist, and I believe in the Big Bang model. Not once in all of those different stages of my life have I ever thought that the Big Bang theory provides evidence for theism. I didn't even think that was when I was a theist. And he says, yeah, but Quentin Smith says that if you're an atheist or a naturalist and you accept the Big Bang theory, then you have to believe it came out of nothing. And this is simply false, because I corresponded privately with Quentin Smith, as well as almost every other atheist philosopher in the United States, Canada, England, and Australia, and I conducted a non-scientific poll, and I'm here to tell you that unanimously, all of the philosophers I asked said that an atheist does not have to believe the universe popped into existence out of nothing if they accept the Big Bang Theory. Quentin Smith wrote to me, and I quote, "I agree with Graham Oppie that William Lane Craig is just relying on slogans, especially when he uses out of nothing, nothing comes." And Quentin Smith in that quotation was referring to Graham Oppie, a Australian philosopher who had written, quote, "I think that this is an instance of Craig's, and by extension Dr. Fernandez, reliance upon slogans. What atheists should want to say is that the universe has no cause. There is the universe, and that's all. There is nothing in this which conflicts with the idea that nothing comes from nothing, because the universe doesn't come from anywhere." And I could produce you an entire page and a half of quotations from virtually every atheist philosopher in the English-speaking and industrialized world who denies what Phil Fernandez says that they believe. He didn't address at all my point about no reason the universe to believe the universe has a cause, because the universe is the origin of space and time. And he didn't address at all the point about the difficulties in accepting a theistic interpretation of the Big Bang. He dropped the argument about the continuing existence of the universe. The design argument was, unless I missed it, it was also dropped. So you would flow all of those counterpoints that I brought up as well. He dropped the moral argument. The next thing that he addressed was the absurdity of life without God, and he says he thinks this is very important. Outside of this room, outside of this debate, I agree with you, but that's why I addressed the point that life can have meaning even though there is no meaning of life. Again, there's a difference between ultimate meaning and personal meaning, and his response to that was, yeah, but if naturalism is true, there is no ultimate meaning. Right, I agree with that, but you never denied the fact that there's personal meaning. And he says that Russell believed, and again, the point about Bertrand Russell is a case in point. He says that Bertrand Russell says there's no ultimate meaning if naturalism is true. Exactly. I've been granting that from the beginning of this debate, but my point is that naturalists believe that there is personal meaning in life, and he can discount that, but I think I speak for most naturalists when I say that personal meaning is more than enough to satisfy us. If Dr. Fernandez doesn't find personal meaning satisfying, that's fine, but we do find it satisfying, and he shouldn't just dismiss that. He didn't address at all his argument about the alleged failure of naturalism in his last speech. Turning to my case for naturalism, he says that most theists would grant this. And I guess that's true. I guess my only response is they may grant it. It may even be logically compatible with theism. But the fact remains that the dependency of the mind on the brain is not what we would expect on theism prior to examining the evidence. And he never addressed that. I'm not making some sort of a deductive argument for naturalism. This is a probabilistic argument. And he never addressed that. He says Habermas and Moreland conducted a study. I'm not familiar with that study, so I don't want to comment it on this debate, but I'd be happy to look into it and correspond with you privately on that matter. He talks about evolution, and he says that the fossil record contradicts evolution, and specifically Colin Patterson admits in a private letter to Luther Sunderland that there was no fossil evidence. This is completely false. I'm actually writing a rebuttal to creationist David Noble. And when I walk over to my laptop before the question and answer period, I'll produce you a quotation from Colin Patterson who says he's been completely misquoted by creationists. Phil Fernandez completely drops my point about biogeography. And as far as molecular biology, he just appeals to Behe, completely ignoring the objection I raised to Michael Behe's work. There are no irreducibly complex systems. Behe's begging the argument. Pain and pleasure, he simply says that, well, God may have some reason for allowing this that we don't know about. Yeah, he may, but as I pointed out in my speech, God may also have reasons we don't know about for preventing pain and pleasure to play the role that they do, and he didn't really address that. He said God uses tragedies like this to lead people to theistic belief. Well, I guess that's one way to look at it. I sort of think that, if there is a God, I don't think he would need to use tragedies. And I guess we're just going to have to appeal to what each member of the audience thinks on this point. That's like saying that in order to get my wife to love me, I have to beat the crap out of her. That's not at all the case. I'm sorry, I just don't buy that. He completely drops my argument about the flourishing and languishing of sentient beings. Again, on the argument from tragedies, he makes points. He says, how does the atheist define evil? Point of clarification, if I'm not mistaken, I never actually used the word evil in my speech, so technically that's irrelevant. But I want to address the claim that atheism or naturalism can't present the problem of evil. What he's missing here is that tragedies are a challenge to the internal coherence of a theistic worldview. Theists believe certain acts are evil. Theists believe God is good. Theists believe good persons are opposed to evil. So Dr. Fernandez needs to explain why a God who is good, in his sense of good, would allow so much apparently pointless evil in his sense of evil. If he can't explain it, then that is a problem for the internal coherence of his worldview, whether or not I have any definition of evil. Turning to the argument about God's silence in the face of tragedies, he's completely dropped that in the debate, and I think that's an extremely powerful argument for naturalism. Religious confusion does not assume that if they all agree, they must be wrong. What he's missing here is that if there is a God, he hasn't clearly revealed the religious path he wants theists to take, and that's not the same thing. As for the argument from reasonable non-belief, that was just completely dropped in the debate. So once again, I think the evidence for naturalism totally outweighs what little we've heard for theism.
Okay, in the limited time that I have, I'd just like to address some of the concerns of and objections of Jeff. Again, with the religious confusion, I'll just add this to it. He assumes every human being is honestly seeking God or honestly open to God's existence. And according to theism, this is especially Christian theism, this is not the case. He alluded to Romans 1, 18 to 22. I believe within each individual is a drive for human autonomy. We want to be our own kings. We want to sit on the throne. But there's also, God has placed within our heart a thirst for him. And some of us favor the human autonomy. Some of us favor the thirst for God. The scriptures teach, seek him and you will find him. So I basically believe God has given us clear evidence. I just believe that we are very good about lying to ourselves and only accepting or interpreting the evidence the way we would like to. Jeff stated that naturalists don't believe the universe popped into existence out of nothing, and he said the universe is just there. He said the universe doesn't come from anywhere. Well, to me, it sounds the same as saying the universe doesn't come from anywhere, it came from nowhere. And so it seems to me like we're just calling nothing by a different name. He talked about, the continuing existence of the universe, okay? My argument does not commit the fallacy of composition. My argument does not deal with emergent properties. Philosophers draw a distinction between emergent properties and additive properties. An emergent property would be that the whole of the elephant is more than the sum of its parts, okay? My argument utilizes additive properties. If all the tiles on a floor are green, then the entire floor is green. If all the aspects of the universe, all the parts of the universe are dependent, then the whole universe is dependent. Now, the atheist can say, no, maybe there's a part of the universe that is independent. Okay, well, number one, that's not a scientific statement because we haven't found that part of the universe yet. And number two, then this independent part of the universe would be the ground of the dependent part of the universe. In other words, the more that we look at this independent part of the universe, the more it begins to look like what the theist calls God. So I think the argument, Aquinas' argument from the contingent existence of the universe is rather strong. The design argument, I did address it. I did speak about Michael Behe's work. And he calls it Darwin's black box. Darwin made a lot of assumptions about the evolution on the molecular level, and now we've opened up those black boxes and we've actually looked there, and so now Michael Behe is saying things like that. Incidentally, scientists who believe in God or reality beyond nature are much more common than popular media stories lead one to believe. There is no reason to think that the figure of 90% of the general population that believes in God is much different from scientists. Ken Miller, whose argument from imperfection I analyzed in the last chapter, is like myself a Roman Catholic, and he makes the point in public talks that belief in evolution is quite compatible with his religious beliefs. I agree with him that they are compatible. The compatibility or lack of compatibility, however, is irrelevant to the scientific question of whether Darwinian evolution of biochemical systems is true. Arno Penzias states that astronomy leads us to a unique event, a universe which was created out of nothing, one with the very delicate balance needed to provide exactly the conditions required to permit life, and one which has an underlying, one might say, supernatural plan. Cosmologist Edward Harrison deduced, here is the cosmological proof of the existence of God, the design argument of Paley updated and refurbished. The fine-tuning of the universe provides prima facie evidence of deistic design. Take your choice, blind chance that requires multitudes of universes or design that requires only one. Many scientists, when they admit their views, incline toward the teleological or design argument. And I can go on and on with quotes from Alan Sandage, winner of the Crawford Prize. He stated, I find it quite improbable that such order came out of chaos. There has to be some organizing principle. God to me is a mystery, but is the explanation for the miracle of existence why there is something instead of nothing. He says he doesn't believe the universe popped into existence out of nothing. That is Jeff. But it seems to me that our choice basically boils down to this. You either got an all-powerful God. I can't explain how God created the universe out of nothing. But a miracle-working all-powerful God creating the universe out of nothing sounds a lot more plausible than total nothingness producing the universe out of nothing. Again, he denies that that's where he's coming from, but he says that the universe doesn't come from anywhere. It's just there. Is he just ignoring the Big Bang model? Is he just ignoring the second law of thermodynamics? Carl Sagan believed in the oscillating model, and it was his hope that maybe someday, 1,500 years from now, science would vindicate him. Well, that means his view is not scientific. Scientific evidence went against his view. Okay, the fine-tuning of the universe, many are turning at this point to the many-universes model, the world ensemble model. An infinite number of parallel universes exist. They don't overlap, therefore we can't confirm their existence. Well, this isn't science. This is speculation, mere speculation. Astrophysicist Hugh Ross says it's a flagrant abuse of probability theory. It assumes the benefits of an infinite sample size without any evidence that the sample size exceeds one. But when you look at theories of quantum physics in an attempt to get around the Big Bang model, quantum tunneling, which pretty much tries to argue the universe popped into existence out of nothing without a cause, but then J.P. Moreland, Christian philosopher, points out that the nothing that they're talking about really isn't a nothing, it's a something. So they're really denying the Big Bang model or choosing to ignore it, because nothing equals no space, no time, no matter, no energy, no rules of quantum physics. Nothing is not an entity which has an equal amount of positive and negative properties. Nothing is nothing. And so many scientists are actually saying, well, really, you know, they're redefining nothing as something. Well, it's fine. Well, where did the something come from? And then it doesn't address the Big Bang model, which teaches that the space, time, energy, universe had a beginning. And I still can't see how naturalism is an explanation at all. You're going back to Bertrand Russell's quote against Frederick Copleston in their famous debate, it's just there. It's just, that's a non-explanation. It's just there. We now have evidence the universe had a beginning. We need to ask how it got there and not just say it's not there. With atheism, there's the ethical naturalism position, which reduces moral values to biological or psychological properties. It's still a rejection of a true ought, universal moral values. Non-cognitivist views of ethics, again, I reject the idea that moral statements are true or false. So neither of these leading atheistic views, explanations of morality, can consistently condemn the torturing of innocent babies as being universally wrong.
We are now at the five-minute closing statement for both of you.
Sorry about that. I got so caught up, I lost track. I want to make one point about the Big Bang model and the beginning of the universe. I'm going to paraphrase him. He says, but naturalism or atheism mystifies the beginning of the universe. It says it's just a brute fact. It offers no explanation, whereas theism explains it. I guess what I want to say is, notice there's going to be brute facts no matter what you believe. In every metaphysical theory, there's going to be brute facts. It is impossible for a theory to explain absolutely everything, even its own basic assumptions. Even theism has a brute fact, namely why God exists instead of absolutely nothing. But what about naturalism's brute fact, that the universe exists instead of just nothing? I guess I just don't see the problem here. To paraphrase theistic philosopher George Mavrides, if I'm saying his name correctly, what's deep in a naturalistic world is matter and energy. So if there's going to be some sort of a brute fact, what else would the brute fact be on naturalism? I don't see the problem here. I don't think Dr. Fernandez addressed any of my arguments for naturalism in his last speech, so I want to go right into my closing statement. And I want to say that if there's one thing the two of us do agree on, it's that this debate has barely scratched the surface. And since the time limits prevented both of us from saying all of our arguments, I don't think anyone should make any life-changing decisions solely on the basis of this one two-hour debate. But I do hope that this debate has caused you to ask questions, begin your own investigation into the evidence, and to read more than just authors who agree with your position. My investigation began about 11 years ago, and it's still ongoing. In that time, I've traveled the full religious spectrum, from a creationist Christian, similar to Dr. Fernandez, to a liberal Christian, to a deist, to an agnostic, to a naturalist. And I would guess that a lot of you probably fall somewhere in the middle of that spectrum. Most of you probably agreed with some of what I've said and some of what Dr. Fernandez has said. In other words, I recognize that naturalism and theism are not the only two philosophical games in town. Even if you ultimately decide to reject naturalism, you still have plenty of other choices left besides theism in general and Christian fundamentalism specifically. Consider my opponent's evidence for theism. He says he's provided a cumulative case, but not all of his arguments show that the theistic God exists. In order to show that theism is true, each of his arguments has to show the existence of a supernatural being that is all-powerful, all-knowing, all-good, creator of the universe, transcendent, and immanent. He hasn't even come close. With all due respect, Dr. Fernandez's so-called cumulative case for theism is like a stack of leaky buckets. No matter how many leaky buckets you add to the stack, you still don't have anything that holds water. But now consider my evidence for naturalism. Nothing mental happens without something physical happening. Complex living things evolve from simple living things. Our nervous systems are not fine-tuned so that we only feel physical pain when it would aid survival. Very few sentient beings thrive, even less thrive for most of their lives. There's an abundance of tragedy in the world. Many of the victims of those tragedies never feel God's comforting presence. If there is a God, he's not clearly revealed the religious path he wants us to take, and non-belief is reasonable. Therefore, I think that the evidence clearly shows that naturalism is more probable than theism.
Okay, basically what I tried to do today was show that there are several different pieces of evidence for theism. It's a cumulative case. That means evidence accumulates with each argument. So Jeff totally misunderstands what a cumulative case is. I'm not saying each and every argument proves everything about the theistic God. I'm saying that as you take a piece of this argument, a piece of that argument, it starts moving in that direction. And that in each and every one of these points, theism is more reasonable to accept than naturalism or atheism. We talked about the origin of the universe. Jeff says with Bertrand Russell, it's just there. Apparently that's not good enough for most people on earth who believe in the existence of some type of God. The continuing existence of the universe, I explain why it does not commit the fallacy of composition. That all dependent existence must have its existence grounded in independent existence. I talked about the design and order found in the universe. And atheists are talking about an infinite number of parallel universes that no one's ever seen to try to wipe out the blind faith of the theist. It makes me wonder, you know, who has blind faith in particular debates like this. Universal moral laws. If you can't say that, you know, atheists protest to try to make this world a better place to live. Well, they're introducing not only a moral law, a moral standard, but a moral standard that they judge even the past on and the present and the future. They want to make the world a better place to live. Well, it seems to me that if that is the case, they're appealing to an eternal, unchanging moral standard. Okay? The absurdity of life without God is not appeal to emotions. If everything you accomplish, if you find out that you build a bridge today, somebody's going to blow it up tomorrow, why build the bridge today? And if atheism is true, it's going to all be blown up. That's not appeal to emotion. That's just the way things are. Talked about the laws of logic and mathematics. Jeff agreed to the existence of the laws of logic. Well, that's some kind of funny-looking furniture in a naturalistic universe. I mean, if everything has physical causes, how did these invisible, unchanging laws of logic, like a law of non-contradiction, just kind of either pop into existence, or maybe they were just there, these invisible entities? Hey, if you're gonna slam a Christian for believing in this invisible God, well, why do you believe in the invisible laws of logic? Many atheists do not, but apparently Jeff does. Jeff stated that I have the burden of proof in this debate. Not so. This debate is not does God exist, where the burden of proof rests on the man arguing for the affirmative. This is theism versus naturalism. My worldview versus his worldview. Nobody has the burden of proof in a debate like this. I will not accept a debate with the title, Does God Exist? Because it places an unfair burden of proof on myself. Sanctity of human life. He admitted that human life, it might be special, but it is not sacred if naturalism is true. Well, that's why the naturalists, the atheists, in the old Soviet Union and in China have killed over 100 million people during peacetime, 100 million of their own people, because human life is not sacred. Once you throw the sanctity of human life out the window, everything else goes with it. In theism, human life is sacred because man was created in God's image, and therefore human life is sacred. Our founding fathers recognized this, although they weren't very consistent with it, that all men are created equal. Charles Darwin did not argue that all men and all women have evolved equally. Okay, it just doesn't follow from the naturalistic position. As far as human free will, and really didn't get a chance to talk about this, but basically, if everything is determined by physical causes, even our decisions, then how can we hold somebody accountable for something that really wasn't their choice? It was just chemically determined. And in closing, The fact of God's existence, I do not believe that it is a mystery. I believe it's clearly seen through his created effects. But since he is infinitely wise, many of his ways and thoughts are often mysterious to us. If I could tell you why God does everything that he does, then it wouldn't be the God of theism. This debate is about God's existence. It's not about attaining an exhaustive knowledge of the workings of an infinitely wise God. On those points that I spoke about, theism is more reasonable than naturalism. Thank you.
A round of applause, I think, is due again for our two fine contestants. We will reassemble in a few minutes. We've got a couple of people here who'd like to take a little bit of a breather and have a little drink of water. Let's get back together in, let's say, 5 minutes at 10 after 3. Okay, 10 minutes, a quarter after 3, according to consensus. And we'll have 45 minutes of question and answer. From often far corners of the universe. Anthony's going to be running up and down this side. If you have a question, I'd like if you could get sort of over here to be recognized, then we'll try and do something in some reasonable order so that Anthony can get to you. What I'd like you to do is to direct a question toward one or the other of our debaters. We'll give a brief opportunity to give a response and then, like a 30-second rebuttal from the one who was not initially asked, if that's agreeable to both of you.
What's the format again? They'll
direct a question to one or the other of you. An answer will be forthcoming, and then the one who was not asked will have a chance to come up with a brief 30-second response.
How long is the initial answer?
Three minutes? I'm thinking 3 minutes will work.
Okay.
All right, okay, I think we have the mic working.
Down here, gentlemen, right down in front here. My
question is for you, Phil. I have a comment and then a question. My comment is that I think that you suffer from a kind of a common misunderstanding as to what science is. Your idea when you were talking about the many worlds theory was that was science. I think that's what you said. And I want to submit for you the idea that science is a system for evaluating claims or evaluating the validity of claims, as opposed to the common misunderstanding of what science is, which commonly people think science is what scientists say. That's my comment. My question is, if there is a God, why was he such a bad designer? I could give the example of my back. My back today, and if you talk to surgeons, as I have, they will tell you this is an incredible weak link in the human system. It was just a bad design. I am no God, but I could design a better back than the one I am afflicted with. My surgeon who did back surgery on me a couple of years ago, who thinks he is a God, he redesigned my back for me. He went in with a chisel he opened up a channel through which my nerve goes, and I suffer a lot less because of that redesign. He did a better job, even though he's a much smaller God than the one you speak of.
I think we have the question here.
Okay, I'd like to say four things. First off, I'd like to preface this with the fact that I have gained more of an appreciation for Daniel in the Lion's Den. I have the impression that there's going to be a lot of people saying that I suffer from something here, and I understand that, and I'm very grateful that you're very gracious, sometimes more gracious than some of my Christian brothers and sisters are to me, with expressing our disagreements. Secondly, it really wasn't a disagreement. Maybe I didn't articulate my position well. I was saying exactly that this wild speculation is not really scientific. But a lot of people, maybe possibly lay people, that are defending the non-theistic position are using it as if it is scientifically proven data.
I didn't say that it's not scientific. specific. I just said it was a claim that needs to be evaluated, mm-hmm. and it hasn't been sufficiently evaluated.
Yeah, and I think some of those claims, it is, by principle, they can't be evaluated. I mean, I hate to bring up, to use Anthony Flew's falsibility principle against himself, but basically, you know, like parallel universes, you know, in principle, you can't look at them and examine them. There's no overlap. But you mentioned God as a bad designer. Number one, he was at least a good enough designer so that your back could be fixed. There's a healing process in human bodies so that your miniature God doctor could fix. I mean, what's the sense of fixing a broken arm if it's not going to heal? So there's a healing process there, but I don't think God's that bad of a designer. I'm a Christian theist, so I do believe God created the universe perfect, created Adam and Eve with perfect backs. We fell in the garden, and there's a lot of built-in consequences to encourage us to get back in the right direction.
Okay. Real briefly, I just want to make 2 points. First, concerning many universes, I want to make it very clear that I never actually said that I believe that there are multiple universes. Remember, I was appealing to Occam's razor, and I just said that if you don't accept my claim that the alleged fine-tuning of the universe is improbable on naturalism, well, you could just as easily say there are many universes as you could say that there are God. And that would be providing an explanation in terms of the known. If you appeal to theism, that's an explanation in terms of the unknown. As far as having a bad back, I sympathize with you. I sometimes have back problems myself. And I want to emphasize that this is something that you would expect given evolutionary naturalism. We evolved from ape-like ancestors, and given that they were not upright, this is exactly what you would expect if evolution is true.
All right, we have a second question right here.
Yes, Phil. There's so many questions I could ask you, but I feel compelled to ask one. I'm an evolutionary paleontologist, and I knew Colin Patterson, the late Colin Patterson. The quote you gave was quoted incredibly out of context. He believes in transitional species. He believes in transitional fossils, and in what he has stated throughout his career is that you can't pinpoint transitional fossils within a cladistic framework. That means an analysis of species using cladism, which is a type of taxonomy. Now, without that restriction, he would recognize transitional fossils, as do many, many other paleontologists and scientists. So my question to you is, would you please investigate the source of that quotation and get it correct, or else please drop it from your presentation, because it is scurrilous, and he has spent many years trying to get away from that, because that's not what he believes.
Okay, well, yeah, I would say this. I am not a scientist, and if I mistakenly used the quote, I apologize. I'll look further into it. At the same time, I was invited here. So if you want a greater scientific mind than Phil Fernandez has, and believe me, there are plenty, you could have got, you know, if you want a major leaguer, you guys can go get a major leaguer. I'll give you a whole list of them. The William Lane Craigs, the J.P. Morelands, that know a lot more than Phil Fernandez does. But this is what you got. And if I am wrong, I stand corrected. I'll look further into it. But I do not claim to be a better philosopher than the philosophers are here today. I do not claim to be a better scientist, not even a scientist, than the scientists who are here today. All I claim is that I believe there is good, solid evidence for Christian theism, and I believe I presented some good evidence, and maybe I missed the boat on one area or another, and I'll look into it, and thank you very much.
I appreciate Dr. Fernandez's gracious willingness to reinvestigate the source of that quotation, because I really do think that this was a quotation out of context, and I don't blame him for that per se. I blame Luther Sunderland. When Patterson was talking about transitional forms, he was referring to his 1978 book entitled Evolution. And if you read that book, you'll see that Patterson believes that we do possess several examples of transitional forms in the fossil record. He says, in mammals, for example, the gap between horses, asses, and zebras, and their closest living relatives, the rhinoceroses and tapirs, is filled by an extensive series of fossils extending back 60 million years to a small animal, which I don't know how to pronounce, Hyracotherium, which can only be distinguished from the rhinoceros tapir group by one or two horse-like details of the skull. So I think it's pretty clear Colin Patterson does believe that there are transitional forms.
Next question.
Thank you. Similar to Steve's comment, I just wanted to ask Dr. Fernandez a quick question. I was attracted to this mainly to hear your positions as described as reasonable or scientifically supported. I'll leave the reason and logic aspects of the philosopher's present. I'm a psychologist. Of the scientific evidence you cited, 100% of it with which I'm familiar, which is not all of it, but 100% of it with which I am familiar, was either outdated, unrepresentative of the field, or completely inverted. And the example I would give was when you were addressing the research by Penfield and Rasmussen and Sperry and other psychophysiologists, where electrodes were implanted in brains and thoughts occurred, memories occurred, movements occurred. You then attributed that as support for a theistic position because the metaphysical realm of decision-making was not addressed. That is not what they were searching. Mm-hmm. None of those researchers you cited concluded that this was evidence for anything metaphysical. It was exactly the opposite, 180 degrees, that things that appear metaphysical to us, that appear non-physical and are in a realm of metaphysics or paranormal or paranatural called consciousness or mind, this was evidence against that because things that appear to us to be paranatural turn out to be entirely physical. So that's another area along Steve's line. I would just ask for your response in general in terms of the quality of the scientific data and the accuracy with which you're quoting it. But on that specific one, I guarantee you all that work and the replications thereof reached exactly the opposite conclusion of the point you used in your argument.
And I would again say now, what I've read of that particular, those particular experiments, it did seem to me that there were surprises. They did not get what exactly it was that they were looking for. At the same time, you know, there are plenty of scientists who are Christians out there, and if you want someone more versed in it, go and get them. And I would like to make one suggestion, though. I would thought that this particular question and answer period would be limited to like a 1 minute question and a 2 minute response by both, no matter who it's related to, because otherwise, because this room is filled with friends of Jeff Lauder, it's actually going to work against him. But it might seem like I'm on the spot, but basically I'm getting 3 minutes to respond. He only gets 30 seconds. So what if we go with 2 minutes?
Well, we can go two and two then. As long as the crucial thing is that we wrap this thing up in about 30 minutes from now. Jeff, do you have any?
Crucial thing is I get on my plane.
Yeah, right.
And get out of town.
Is there anything? All right. We've got a question at the back of the room here.
Thank you. Just since all the other questions were prefaced by a 30-second comment, I'd like to make a comment. As a Christian theist who attended the entire conference, I would like to thank you who put this on, the work that you did. I thought the conference went very well. I thought there were a lot of stimulating papers, and I've got a lot to think about and consider when I go back to Charlotte, so I want to express my thanks. My question is to Mr. Lauder. I thought I heard you concur with Dr. Fernandez's commitment to the dictum or the law that everything that begins to exist has a cause of its existence. But then later, I thought I heard you say that time and space began to exist but did not need a cause. And if you said those, how would you resolve that contradiction?
Yes, actually, that's not quite what I said, and this is a very subtle distinction. So this is probably a good thing for me to try and explain again what my position is. What I said is that anything that begins to exist in space and time has a cause. William Lane Craig, for example, in his debates, I think I once heard him talk about the absurdity of believing that you could sit in your living room watching TV and a tiger could just pop into existence in your living room out of nothing. That would be an example of an event in space and time, and I agree that would be absurd to say that something like that could happen. What I'm saying is there's a difference between that kind of an event and the origin of space and time itself. All of our experiences, our metaphysical intuitions, all of the support that Craig, Fernandez, and other theists have brought in support of their causal principle, I think are just completely irrelevant to the very origin of space and time, and therefore I see no reason at all to believe that the beginning of the universe, if the Big Bang Theory is true, needs a cause.
And I would basically respond, and he doesn't like the Thomistic argument from dependency, if all the things in nature need a cause, then when you collect them all together, you get one big group of dependent things that still need a cause for their continuing existence. So I think that the law of causality within space and time argues or at least favors very strongly the theistic position that therefore the whole collection of these dependent things needs a cause.
All right, we have a question over here then.
Yes, I want to mention a point of agreement with Dr. Fernandez, and that's that we both agree on the laws of logic. So I just want to check with two premises of your syllogism if we can agree on the conclusion. Because in talking about the problems of the human concept of infinity, you said infinity doesn't exist except as a concept in the human mind. Then you said God is infinite. Can we then conclude that therefore God doesn't exist except as a concept within the human mind?
That's a good question. It's a very good question. The only problem is, sir, and I don't mean it in any bad way, but you're misreading me. I said that an actual infinite set cannot exist outside of a mind. So if there's an actual infinite set of things that can exist in a mind, guess what kind of mind it would be? It would be an actually infinite mind. And so basically what I'm arguing is that God knows an actually infinite number of things. Now, you can't get there through successive addition, so that means he must know them innately in one eternal glance. Now, this is Thomism, you know, Thomas Aquinas and that type of thing, and you may reject it. But I'm not saying an actual infinite set can exist in a human finite mind. I'm saying it can exist in a mind. But when we look at what kind of mind it's got to be an infinite mind. So I don't see a real glaring problem there. Now, if you explain me how an infinite mind can know an infinite number of things, I'd say go ask the infinite mind.
I haven't really talked about the possibility of an actual infinite because for purposes of this debate, it's irrelevant to my position because I accept the fact of Big Bang Theory. So there would be no point in me defending the possibility of an actual infinite because I don't believe that the universe is infinitely old. That's all I have to say.
Right. We have another question toward the back of the room here. All right.
My question is for Jay. It seemed that throughout the debate, especially the opening remarks, you made a number of observations. To name a few, tragedies occurring, biological role of pain and pleasure, as well as religious confusion. I believe that you preceded these observations by saying that given these particular occurrences and observations, which I named, the existence of God or theism seems rather unreasonable or improbable. If that's correct, my question is this: where is it that you're getting your from that leads you to believe that theism or God's existence would be improbable given these things? That is, how are you determining this probability?
We'd have to really address your question. I'd have to talk about a specific argument. But in general, I thought I answered this in my speech. I tried to explain why, given some fact about our world, that would be surprising. It would not be what we would expect given theism. Several of my arguments, you'll notice, had to do with things that we would that I say are improbable on theism, because they are facts that would only be true if God had a morally sufficient reason for allowing them. And in my speech, I tried to argue that the odds that there were such a moral reason is pretty unlikely. I tried to argue that it was more likely on naturalism than on theism. Technically, what I'm using is epistemic conditional antecedent probability. I don't know if that answers your question. It's hard to talk in generalities. We'd have to go into a specific argument.
I would say that basically, just in response to that, that the theist doesn't have to argue that this is the greatest possible world, but he would have to argue this is the greatest possible way to achieve the greatest possible world, i.e. what the Bible calls heaven, and that God often uses evil and human suffering to draw people to himself. Now, God's ways and thoughts are far above our understanding. Even the scriptures state that. So at best, atheistic arguments show that limited minds cannot fully understand why God allows so much evil. But that's only expected if you believe in the existence of an infinite God. And only God knows the right amount of evil and human suffering. I mean, where do you draw the line? Suppose we draw the line all the way back so that only one guy on earth doesn't get saved. Well, then the atheist would still scream, well, that's unfair. That's too much suffering because he's the only one that's not going to heaven. So where do you draw the line? I believe God knows where to draw the line, and he brings about the greatest good which I believe is the maximum amount of people in heaven fellowshipping with him for all eternity.
We have a question over here.
Hi, Mr. Fernandez, I realize that you may not have had all the time you would have liked to address Mr. Lauder's questions and his points during his argument, but I'd like to give you a chance to rectify that, because I really would like a bit more explanation on why God is silent, say, for instance, during Mr. Lauder's description of a three-year-old child with leukemia. Why isn't God like that towards people who have such tragedies?
Yeah, and I think I basically responded to in the last question that basically, as Isaiah 55, 8 and 9 says, that God's ways and his thoughts are often as far above ours as the heavens are above the earth. I cannot give you an answer for every particular reason, but I do think that the evidence that I provided, the origin of the universe, the continuing existence of the universe, the existence of absolute moral values, design and complexity found in the universe, demand that there be an infinite being to ground the existence of the universe. Now, I'm not saying that, therefore, we can fully and exhaustively know the ways of this God. I do think that many theists pretend to know all the reasons why God allows evil and human suffering. If someone's in here and your baby died, I'll give you a hug and a shoulder to cry on, but I'm probably not going to give you a philosophical answer. Now, anybody who tells you that they've got the God of the Bible all figured out, it's not the God of the Bible.
Well, I guess I would just say in response to that, again, even if God, assuming that there were a God, and he had reasons for allowing tragedies like a three-year-old with leukemia, reasons that were too complicated for us little humans to understand, I still have not heard any reason at all why God does not consistently comfort people who are victims of these tragedies. And again, if you were the parent of a three-year-old son with leukemia who had to go get chemotherapy twice a week, he wouldn't be in doubt about your love. And he certainly wouldn't be in doubt about your existence. So I think this is just really strong evidence for naturalism.
Another question here, then.
This is for Dr. Fernandez. I'm wondering about the idea of a part-time God. And what I mean by that is I hear people describe themselves as people persons. And then the theistic explanation of the universe and all of that seems to presuppose a people-oriented God. If we have a people-oriented God, then it would seem that if God is omniscient, omnipresent, and all that, that that our concerns can be taken care of in no time flat. But my real concern, I guess, is what does God do when he's not worrying about people? There are pieces of the universe that we will never see, that no person will ever see. Why would we have a God who is concerned with people, who then has other chunks of the universe out there that are totally irrelevant to us? Presumably, he's playing cat's cradle or something like that. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I think it's a good question. I think if God created a fairly small universe so he could explore every inch of it in a small amount of time, then I think the atheist objection would be, well, God doesn't have to be all-powerful because look how small the universe is. I mean, you know, if we had enough time, we could do it ourselves. I think part of this vast, immense universe that we can never totally figure out is God giving us a big clue, and that is that he is infinite in power. He is the creator, and we have this vast universe that we'll never totally figure out. So an atheist act like the theist needs to totally figure out his God, or his God is not worthy of belief. I just think it misses the point. But I do think that God created a very big, vast universe so that man can look and give glory to God and have an experience of wonder and awe at this great, vast creation. Obviously, the atheist would disagree.
I don't know. I think this is sort of a draw. I mean, yeah, we've got this really big universe, and you've got the points that Dr. Fernandez brought up, but on the other hand, you've got this really big universe. And I'm reminded of, the movie Contact, based on the book by Carl Sagan, and to paraphrase Dr. Arroway, I mean, it just seems like an awful waste of space. I don't know that proves anything for naturalism or for theism. I think this is sort of a draw.
This is to Dr. Fernandez. You said that God uses human suffering to man, to also bring man to him. What about animal suffering? Animals have no stake in salvation whatsoever. There can be no justifiable reason for animal suffering. What kind of God is that?
Basically, it's another good question, but I believe, you know, I am the type of theist that is called a Christian theist. I suppose traditional Jewish theists also would agree that God created man as the pinnacle of his creation, but then he also created the world and gave man dominion over it. So now we are not to abuse the gifts that God has given us, but I do view the animal kingdom as a gift to mankind. Now, obviously, you step outside of a theistic framework, and if you lower the status of human beings and raise the status of animals, then you can make a case against it. But I don't see any reason to step outside the theistic framework, especially because of things like the Big Bang model and the impossibility of an actual infinite set existing outside of a mind.
Again, I'd go back to my opening statement. You might remember that my fourth line of evidence for naturalism was the flourishing and languishing of sentient beings. Other animals, they're not moral agents. We don't hold a chimpanzee morally responsible for how it behaves. But a chimpanzee is a sentient being. It is capable of feeling pain. And therefore, moral agents, which includes humans and God, if God exists, are therefore morally responsible for how they treat sentient beings that are not human. And I don't think we've heard any reason at all why theism, if theism is true, we'd find this this pattern that we see with the flourishing and languishing of sentient beings. I think that's an excellent question.
Dr. Fernandez,
I'm sorry, I need to interject here. I'd like to request that we alternate who the question is directed to.
Oh, it's
hard. If there are questions for me, I just
All right, Dr. Fernandez, you said that evil was necessary for moral perfection. That's incoherent because a tidal wave or a flood that kills thousands of children is hardly character building. And the people who survive with respect to them, like their parents, instead of strengthening their character, the trauma might crush them and they'll be back up.
I didn't say it was necessary for moral profession, although I do think that some cases of evil are necessary for moral perfection in this fallen world. There would be no such thing as being courageous if there was no evil person to fear. You couldn't love your enemies in a perfect world because we'd all be friends, things of that sort. But I'm not saying that in every single case it's essential to moral perfection. What I am saying is, in every case, if the all-good, all-powerful God of the Bible does exist, and I believe there is evidence that he does exist, very good evidence that he does exist, that theism is more plausible than naturalism, then there's good evidence that even though we don't know the answers as to why God allowed some horrible incident to occur, we can trust him that he had some greater good reasons for it. And then that's exactly what the book of Job is about. So, very ancient book, and it already addressed that question. I think just the fact that the Bible addressed questions that are still current today back that far is evidence in itself that theism is onto something.
I don't know. I go back to my opening statement. I tried to present several lines of evidence with a theme from biology. The pattern of the types of pain and suffering we find, the patterns of pain and suffering. We can talk about things like moral perfection and greater goods, but when it all boils down to it, the fact of the matter is naturalism has an explanation and theism doesn't.
This question is for Mr. Fernandez, but Mr. Lauer could answer it as well.